Ja, hallo, schönen guten Abend.
Hello.
Yeah, hello, I'm Sepp. Nice that you're here. We're from Kados and keep the introduction short. For anyone who doesn't know Kados, we're a humanitarian aid organization based in Berlin. One special thing about us is that we're very well connected in the nerd and hacker community, and that we have our own hacker space in Berlin that is dedicated to work and invent and hack things for humanitarian missions. Maybe that's not the most obvious thing, because you would think that for catastrophes there are resources available. However, there's lots of wars and lots of disasters that need help, and there's more what's called asymmetric conflicts, where there's less organizations who are willing and able to go to these areas. Also, the amount of people on the move and displaced people is increasing, and the amount of climate catastrophes is increasing. I hope we don't have any climate change deniers here. And it's not something that we came up with. Also, like, the Organization of Insurance Companies came up with these statistics. And so the general trend is there's more catastrophes and comparatively less resources for them. And in Germany, we have to prepare for more horrible weathers and weather patterns, but other countries are even more affected than we are.
So the question is, how do you prepare for this? And preppers don't have the best reputation around here. Also, because the question is also, what are preppers? What do they? How do you prepare for something? And why do we need you, the chaos community, hacking disasters to prepare ourselves well for everything that's coming? So we have some examples for this. One thing is the technical aspect. There's a lot of technology. If I look around here, I always find more new gadgets, new fancy developments, but it always takes a long time until it's usable in practice. So an example from a few years ago was this federal a warning day. Cell broadcast was just not existent in Germany, and nobody had noticed this until we tried it out and noticed, oh, there is a gap there. By now it's working, but this took several years until this technological development. So I remember after this warning day, I was at the Chaos Congress, and everyone was like, hey, why do we not have this? A cell broadcast is completely obvious. And so one thing is having this technological level where we can use you all for, and the other thing is the organizational question. So you might remember the flooding of the Ahrtal. This was a big disaster. Nobody saw it coming, really, but the climate crisis has arrived here in Germany and is doing massive amounts of damages. So this went horribly wrong. So the population, even 1 year later, wasn't thrilled by politics and insurances, and so people wondered, how could this happen? Because amusingly, the Federal Institute for Population Protection is 1.13 kilometers away from this Ahrweiler, where these images that we just saw happened. And so I actually studied at the Academy for Population Control, and I did the Master of Disaster. It's actually called that. And so in 2018, 3 years before this flooding, we had a final exam, and this final exam had as a component flooding on the Ahr, and I thought, oh dear, if there's actually a flooding there, then we should run up a mountain, because this is not going to go well. And why is it not going well? So when the actual flooding came, they did an effort to call the armed forces, for instance, and they arrived a few days later with solid equipment. You can't look out of it, but you can pull things away with that kind of tank, but what could have gone faster? So what these tanks did there, an old tractor could have done as well. But at this Federal Academy for Plantation Protection, nobody had the number of Peter Lustig, so there wasn't any tractors available. So there were communication problems where you could improve a lot of things. How come? So the catastrophe protection is a pyramid. So this is just a symbolic image. That's a German politics joke. It doesn't always work well. So how else can you organize yourself? And that is a topic in the chaos community. So how can you organize yourself? So we wanted to talk to you how you can hack disasters, so to say. And so during the hacking, I learned there's always several aspects where you can hack into things. So there's the hardware, which in this case means not just computers. Then there's the software, which is great. And then the social aspect or social engineering. And there we've brought a couple of real examples how this can go, what do we have in mind, and then you can start to develop some of your own projects and come into your makerspace, and then we are starting with a hardware project.
Yes, so because I don't know anything about digital things, so I'm going to talk about the hardware project. And we've been in Ukraine for about 2 years, working right now in evacuation of highly injured patients. And one big problem that we've had was that there's lots of injured patients, but very few ambulances. So the idea was, what could we do to solve this problem? Of course, one idea of transporting more people with less cars would be having a ambulance bus. But however, they're really, really expensive if you buy them, and hard to get. And we found out that we wouldn't get enough ambulances in time. And so we decided, okay, well, just buy an old bus and put things into it, because, you know, a hack can be something small. And what exactly are the things that we need? So we can put our equipment in, 3D print some of the equipment, and then we have to see how can we safely transport patients. They have to transport lying down, they can't sit. So, of course, we need to make sure that they get safely attached. And the stretchers are TÜV certified, and the attachment ropes are also TÜV certified. So how do we get that into a bus? And found out that the spots where the seats would normally be have attachment lanes where instead you could take the seats out and we could put the stretchers there. And the only thing that we're missing was this small metal attachment bit that you see on the bottom right, that where we could attach the straps. And so we found someone who is good at working with metal and who could calculate, you know, how thick does the metal have to be, how does it have to be welded together. And then it was built, and we ended up building this in, and we basically now built a driving ICU that is now still in service in Ukraine, and it costs less than 30,000, which normally, if you buy it from stock, it costs like 500,000.
So sometimes the solutions can be really in the small things, but sometimes we think bigger. So this is another hardware project. We did this sketch on a bit of kitchen towel. We were working together with Sea Watch, doing flights over the Mediterranean Sea, and wondering, what if you took old emergency parachutes and then used them to throw down emergency supplies? And I bet a crate of beer to say, that's never going to work. We're never going to get that certified. And other people said, yeah, that's possible. And then we did that together with the Humanitarian Piles Initiative. So we added some damping systems and tried them out in our hacking space, and I still didn't believe in it, and we did the first tests, and then I started to think, okay, it might actually work, and then we actually got this certified, and by now it's working really well, as we can hopefully see here. And what we want to show with this is if you come to the hackerspace with us, you can bring a lot of crazy ideas, and you're going to meet a lot of crazy people there who want to collaborate, and then in the end, you're going to hit the target more often than you might think.
So as a little extra information, like how did we get to this? Like airdrops, normally only the military or the super big supranational help programs can do this, because it's very complicated. You need a landing strip that's like cleared. You need a lot of personnel. And what we developed, you can throw out of a small plane, you know, somewhere like where there was a landslide. You can load payloads of different sizes, about like 150 kilos. And it's also fairly cheap because it uses the old reserve parachutes of paragliders.
And now we're coming to a project that's more about social engineering. That's also part of hacking. So there's the Kabul Air Bridge. So this was another crazy idea. Teresa, I think she's also here, called me and said the Taliban just captured Kabul. Can we send a plane there? Because she knew that I had to do with planes. And I said, that's crazy, but let's try it. And we phoned around a whole lot and started to lose track of where we had distributed people. And then we had to have the clocks there with different time zones. And we did some work with the media as well. And in the end, we actually organized a plane, which created a small scandal, because then in Cairo there was suddenly a plane with NATO markings, which we had phoned ourselves in, and then this actually flew into Kabul. The silly thing was that the whole evacuation over the airport only worked, did work so well, but then we were there, we had some money already, and at this opportunity we already met a lot of people. So shout out to Mela and Vesna and everyone who is still there today and still maintaining this Kabul air bridge. And especially we noticed that another thing if you're hacking is you sometimes notice that the first road you take isn't the best one to get to the goal, because the Kabul air bridge quickly turned into the Kabul minibus bridge. We noticed it's easier to do it over land. So this is something else that is part of the experience, trying to find other solutions. And so this is another invitation to you all to start these projects with us. And if it doesn't work out, then we just try a second time. So much for social engineering.
Now, the next aspect is software solutions. That's also something that we do in the area of disaster relief and that we need a lot. One example with which we worked is the civil coordination line in the medieval sea to coordinate civilian rescue vessels. There's the alarm form, there's all these ships, and there's lots of emergencies. And how do you coordinate all of them so that they all go to the correct area to go into a mission? And of course, normally that is done by the official coordination center. However, that has been, like, they haven't been doing that terribly well. And they've denied aid in lots of cases. So we wrote our own geoinformation system. And Nick, who's also here, who gave a talk yesterday, found out in Gaza that you can also use it, the same software, to increase the coordination between humanitarian aid workers and missions. So for example, you still see at the top left of this the little ship from the medieval missions, but here you see it's used actually on Gaza. So we're reusing existing solutions that we've did for one mission or setting, and we can throw it onto other areas as well and reuse it.
So now we've rushed through several problems which touch either one aspect, hardware or another, social engineering or software, and there are of course projects that combine all of these aspects, and this is a bit too much for me, so I'll pass over to Dr. Schaefer, who can describe the more complex projects.
Thank you very much for this nice introduction. So now we're talking about communication infrastructure for the humanitarian aid, emergency aid, for rescue and aid teams. Communication equipment is incredibly essential to be able to coordinate and be able to do their jobs and their mission. And at the same time, in areas of catastrophes and conflicts, this infrastructure is generally damaged and or broken and or have been disabled on purpose. For example, in areas of war zones, one party will try to disable and shut down the mobile communication systems of the other party to harm them. For example, some satellite suppliers have political or commercial interests. So, for example, there's one very well-known efficient satellite system that tends to be shut off every once in a while for political reason. And when we went to Gaza with Qatar, then there was strong restrictions on communication infrastructure that we weren't allowed to bring in. There is a process that has lots of bureaucratic hurdles, and you have to have lots of time and paperwork, and about like 1 year later you maybe are able to use your satellite phone in Gaza. But however, we're doing short-term immediately relief work, that was not a way we could do. So we had to come up with our own tricks of social engineering to get our phones in. We will not disclose those because we still need them. So we're going to switch over to natural disasters, where there's also often damaged infrastructure, communication infrastructure. Fiberglass wires are damaged, which can often be fixed relatively quickly. But also like damaged power lines are a big issue. Like cell towers need energy to work if the power lines are broken. If there's no energy going to the cell tower, then they don't work. And when they're run using generators and supplied with energy, then that only works as long as you can get fuel to these generators. So if that infrastructure is damaged, they don't work. So that means generally if you have earthquakes and disasters with large scale destructions in the four times, in the short days, then lots of communication infrastructure will be down for a substantial amount of time until it can get improved and repaired. And in this area, we also work as CADOS. We're involved in a research project that is called 5G Sprint. We'll do it together with the Fraunhofer Institute and the TH Wildau. And this here is kind of the ingredients of this research project. We're trying to build a 5G mobile signal cell into the air and try to provide communications within a specific area where communication is broken. We have a testing area here on an airstrip here, where we build up a scenario with a CADOS ambulance that is deployed in an emergency area. Then a self-built surveillance drone from the TH Wildau, a autonomous measurement sensor robot, and this flying cell tower, which is a plane that has a signal transmitter in it. And when the airplane flies in circles over a specifically damaged area, and below that the drone flies and sends video data, so sending that data to the coordination center that can then communicate with the ground teams and help them navigate, for example, finding patients, and also if we need, for example, telemedicine for extra know-how that can also be supplied with this extra network. And here you see this autonomous measurement robot that's supposed to measure the cell connection in this project, and you can see the signal's quite good. There's low latency, and it works quite well. And so that means we can also transport ultrasound data and similar data as well. If you're interested in this project, you can reach out to the GSM team on this Congress. There's people involved in this research project who will happily tell you more about the details of this. And of course, we CADOS are also interested in more of these research projects. And we're always happy to be invited as like a practical partner for these kind of projects.
And we are staying in the air for another moment. So stop playing. We have, together with the Technical University for Technology and Economy in Berlin, we've built this little drone to use in humanitarian rescue missions, also to evaluate damage situations. Play it again, maybe. So as you can see, no. So it's a bit unstable in its flight, so it's not super easy to handle, and it can't do very much yet, so for this reason, it's not yet really suitable for rescue missions. So the project of the self-built drone, it hasn't been given up yet, but it's been pushed to the side, and with a heavy heart, but we have gotten to a proprietary solution, which you can also see at our area near Bits and Bäume, if you want. So there we're currently working with this drone, sadly, to record data. So that's data points that can then map the terrain pretty well, or display it, so you can show the contours of the terrain, but also different damage situations and evaluate those. And we would like to take this proprietary generated data of the drone and turn that into free software and then evaluate it there. So this is currently not working quite well. If you have some ideas there, then please come to our booth and write us and visit our makerspace. So we can definitely use help there. Or if in general you're interested in the subject of drones and humanitarian aid, then please get in touch. We also have additional technical subjects where we can use more help, such as radio. So if people want to give us radio trainings, and of course also the subjects mentioned earlier, there's a lot of support we need there as well. So if you're interested, then please get in touch or visit us. We will be very happy to hear your hacky ideas. Thank you.
And of course, the challenge, if you see anything here at CCC, anything that blinks, that walks, robot, unicorns, fancy new radio technologies, and you have any idea in how this could be used in our context, then please come join us near Bits and Bäume. And we'd love to talk to you, share some wishes and ideas and projects.
Haben wir Fragen aus dem Publikum?
Any questions from the audience? Hello, thank you very much for your presentation. You talked about this 5G drone, which probably has a satellite uplink, or why don't you directly use the satellite? Because it doesn't feel like it's primarily for the people who are living there in the area.
Yeah, thank you for this question. I actually forgot a little bit. If you do it with a 5G network, there's a plane that is sending it out, not a drone, and it sends it out just in the area that it is covering. However, if you add a satellite uplink to it, then you can also communicate with, you know, a back office further away or similar area, places. But you also don't have to put a 5G cell into it. You can also do GSM or LTE. That's very exchangeable. It also doesn't have to be an ultralight plane. Can also be a different small plane like the one that we saw earlier doing the airdrops. It's fairly modular. And if you do it with GSM or LTE instead, then it's also easier to give people who need help on the ground a way to communicate, which is actually a little difficult with 5G.
First of all, thanks for this presentation. It was very cool. This 5G cell, you put this into a very light plane. And then at the very end, you showed this proprietary drone. Do you have any plans to combine this? So the drone and the 5G cell or LTE or whatever?
Yes. There is a next iteration of this research project which it'll go a little bit more around about drones again, but that one's still very much in the research stage and not out in the field at all. However, if any of you have ideas on how to speed up this project, please come by and reach out, and we'd love to talk.
Thank you very much from me as well. I'm interested, what your specific use case for the LiDAR data? So that's kind of 3D point clouds, and you can use that to map terrain at a certain point in time, but it can also help if you have mapping of the area before. So what's your specific use case? Why do you want to have this data and not use, for instance, aerial photography?
I can try to answer that question. So really, one thing that's really interesting is with the LiDAR data, we can also look at forested areas. I don't actually have that much knowledge about this field. Someone has explained it to me. But you can look through the leafy roof of the forest. So having these point clouds helps with mapping and interpreting this destruction. And it helps getting a better idea of, for example, landslides.
And
especially with houses that were destroyed by war, the roofs might still be intact often. And then with a vertical aerial photograph, you can't really judge how big the destruction is. And then it helps if you have more precise data.
Gibt's noch weitere Fragen?
Are there any more questions?
Danke euch für eure Arbeit.
Thank you for your work and for this presentation. I have a more specific question about this bus. I didn't quite see it. What did you do about vibration disturbance? So a striker is normally on a table with springs. So if I drive this bus through rough terrain, what do you do?
You're right. We didn't actually do anything about that. Like the we, like in Germany, good ambulances have a like dampened table for these kind of stretchers. However, in Ukraine, none of the ambulance have that anyway. There's also like heavy weight transportation systems that directly put it on the floor. And in this case, we didn't do anything to dampen vibrations. It was just used as is.
Wir hätten noch Zeit für mehr.
We have time for more questions. Yes. How does the contact with other or larger help organizations work? So I was thinking of maybe the THW in Germany or the Doctors Without Borders, because they have a different approach. And also thanks for the presentation.
Well, how do I answer these questions? Do you want to answer? Every organization has its own culture, and the THW, the German Technical Help Works, and they are partly governmental. They have a lot of resources provided by the state, and they have a much narrower spectrum of where they work than we do. Like, we can go into war zones, the THW cannot do that. But we do talk with each other. We use the same like proprietary resources for water filtration, and MSF is its own little universe. They have their own logistics. They're so large that they are large enough that they don't even have to do certain detail solutions like we need to do. It is fantastic that works. We're somewhat jealous about that we cannot afford doing this, but it means that there's also not that much like research partnership between each other, because the situations are just a little different. And we've worked together in Ukraine and Gaza on like the operational level in the field, but not on the, let's call it the creative area, making new tools.
Yeah, so what we are doing in our space is our own workplace. So that's not something other organizations do. They do more plug and play. So we sometimes do this as well. We don't invent something new all the time. So sometimes we just send medical personnel and then they do their work there. So that's the humanitarian work. And we have this makerspace and invite all of you to come there with your projects, because in the small scale you can sometimes develop solutions that also work on the big scale, and then the larger players might start to copy that.
Yeah, also thank you very much. Very inspiring. I know the story of the Kabul Air Bridge. How do you get into this area when there has been a disaster happening?
You're sitting right next to the right person you can ask. So Ella is there, our joker, whenever we need to order things in Afghanistan, even now. So at that time, we just annoyed people so long until we had the phone number of the Minister of the Exterior, and then we called so long that until we had the NATO call sign, and then with that, we called the Americans and got the permission to land.
Yeah, danke für den Talk.
Thank you for the talk. You've been talking mostly about like these really big projects. Do you also have like little things that you use in the field or that help you kind of every day that were done in the makerspace? Like, for example, I don't know. Any small projects?
Not really. So if we go into the field, we have to take the stuff that we have, not printed there, but we build a lot of our own equipment, such as the inlays for some kind of boxes that store all the radio equipment. Or so if we're going to risky areas like Gaza, where we have to pack extremely well and take as few suitcases as we can. So there's also very simple stuff like late cases. So there's things that don't have to be as sophisticated.
Yeah, one project we forgot that we actually wanted to talk about was the digital air bridge, about exactly this. So at the beginning of the war in Ukraine, we send mobile makerspaces into Ukraine to rebuild things, and that will continue to be a topic over the next couple of years, that lots of things need to be repaired and lots of places that are damages. And then the question is, how can we fix that? A lot of them might still be repairable. So the question is, how do you then fix that? How do you make parts? Can you send 3D printers there? That's one problem. But also, do you have other people who can design and build build the parts? And that's also something that we'll probably talk about in the future with you all in this hacker context, and hopefully find people to do or help with that.
If it's possible, can you give an overview over the next months, what kind of projects are coming up? And if it's okay to ask, how do you finance yourselves?
Through your donations? No, of course. These projects are mostly financed through donations. Our operative missions are also supported through governmental and other sources, like the WHO or other sources. But everything that's like innovative and developmental is carried by donations in general. We will think about going to Sudan in the next little while, but we're currently debating that, because it would be the third war zone that we do in parallel. And of course, that also means that there's lots going on in the makerspace. That's where we do the trainings. We also have one or two small projects. Want to do a universal carriage container that for all the ICU equipment to attach to the stretches for our transports in Ukraine. Then let's think about if there's anything else coming up right now. But those are some little examples.
So it's cool that you're such a small group and can try out so many creative things in your makerspace. I assume you make it available open source. And now, question about the practical application. So with the bus, for instance, it's a very simple idea that in theory anyone could reproduce. Does this happen in practice? Has someone else rebuilt this project? Or?
Let me say yes, no, kinda. It's been published and it's open sourced on somewhere on relevant platforms. But also, for example, like I'm going around the other way. So, for example, WHO is now putting out callouts for conversion kits for ambulances. So, for example, that's something where this kind of project fits in quite well. And however, the question is always like, are there groups on the ground who actually execute this? So, for example, in Ukraine, there's lots of places where people make parts and do these kind of projects. But in other areas, there's a lot less of like a makerspace culture. So that... that's not necessarily always the case, and but we're trying to spreading these ideas. They're also being used, but how much they're being used, like locally in all the different places, that is highly dependent on the location.
So we also have a mobile makerspace that we brought into Ukraine together with other Ukrainian organizations. We brought this idea to life, and now there are several mobile makerspaces there. So there's this Tolokar project, I think, and it worked pretty well and grew bigger.
Thank you for your work. One question. If you say you're going into areas of war like Ukraine, are you sending the ambulance there with people from you, or are you educating and training people in your makerspace locally who work there?
Both, really. So we've done a training project training people in Ukraine, but at the same time, we are sending crews into the field, and then those are people who have some kind of education in their area of expertise and maybe also some experience in these regions, but then we do some special training for them for hostile environment awareness trainings before they go there.
Then, as a last information from us, you can find Kados here at Bits and Bäume. And now I would like to ask for another big applause. Thank you very much for the.